But right now, I want to introduce our first guest, and that is Gareth Porter, historian, journalist, and author. And we're going to be talking about a recent article written by Gareth Porter, McChrystal. This is an article about the Afghanistan war, and it's McChrystal faces Iraq 2006 moment in the coming months. Gareth, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
And Gareth, I wonder if you would just say a word about your focus of study, because your book, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam, really talks about some of the same things we saw in Southeast Asia back 40 years ago that we're seeing today, post 9/11.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, there's a sense of deja vu all over again here in my life because of the fact that I was very much involved in the Vietnam era issue of U.S. Military power being abused in another part of the world, with very similar situation that existed at the global level in the 1950s and early 60s, which we find in today's world, which is U.S. military dominance in the sense of no other power in the world that could really deter directly through military force the United States in terms of its military expansion around the world, and particularly in Southeast Asia. And what I argue in that book about how and why the United States stumbled into war in Vietnam, and I do believe that it was a stumble in a very meaningful sense, is that it was the very dominance of the United States that created incentives for the U.S. national security state to, bit by bit, step by step, go deeper and deeper into Vietnam militarily. The assumption being that the United States could really not go wrong, because even if the problem within South Vietnam turned out to be a bit more difficult than we imagined, we could always put more troops in, and then we could deter the other side, the Vietnamese communists, from upping the ante, at least from North Vietnam, by threatening to destroy the country in the northern part of Vietnam. And that, of course, turned out to be a fundamentally flawed assumption. And I think, you can see something very similar. It's quite a parallel occurrence in the case of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It was based on very similar notions about U.S. dominance and the fact that we couldn't really go wrong.
Well, Gareth, I wanted to bring this discussion, as you talk about the deja vu all over again, Southeast Asia and the wars we're currently fighting as a nation in Afghanistan and Iraq, to talk about Afghanistan. It seems that the focus has shifted by the Obama administration's pre-election promise that they were going to funnel more troops to Afghanistan. And we've seen some major offenses in this area called Marja. We can talk about a little bit. But as we begin, I just wanted to find your assessment of the status of things in Afghanistan. Just today, in today's paper, we're reading about 9 NATO soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan, including 4 in a helicopter crash in southern Afghanistan. And there have been, as I read it, a lot more suicide bombings and assassinations of government officials. Violence is on the rise.
Well, the title of this article that you just mentioned a few moments ago is that McChrystal faces an Iraq 2006 moment. And by what I meant by that is that I think that there is a very clear parallel here between the situation that exists politically in the United States today with regard to the war in Afghanistan and the situation that existed in 2006 with regard to Iraq. And the parallel is that in Iraq in 2006, what was happening was that the war was so clearly turning into a sort of a sectarian civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia, particularly in Baghdad, that the United States military was powerless to really affect. And the way in which that story played out day after day in the news media was so demoralizing, not just for the U.S. public or primarily for the U.S. public, but rather for the political elite itself in Washington, D.C., members of Congress, the sort of punditry, the unelected elite, the foreign policy elite, all these people were watching this unfold and saying, oh, my God, this is no good. This isn't working at all. We've got to do something. We've got to do something different. And that's where you get the Baker-Hamilton report, the Baker-Hamilton committee report, really urging a process of de-escalation and withdrawal, beginning withdrawal from Iraq. This, I think, is already beginning to happen. The same process is beginning to happen in Afghanistan if you understand that the McChrystal strategy, the so-called counterinsurgency strategy, that depended on being able to protect, quote-unquote, the population from the Taliban and thus sort of draw them into a process whereby they would get governance reform and development. This has simply and utterly failed in such an obvious way that I think that the media coverage is bound to begin to pick up the same theme and replay it many times in the coming weeks and months by the very nature of the war itself and the failure of the strategy. And so I think that we are indeed headed down that road of a meltdown of political support on the part of the political elite, a kind of political crisis, if you will, over the war, which leaves the administration then with a choice of accelerated withdrawal or sort of doubling down, as the Bush administration did in Iraq, in the form of an escalation and in the form of a surge and some sort of new strategy. I think it's going to be very difficult to come up with a formula that would be at all credible, that would be matching the Petraeus strategy of counterinsurgency for Iraq, and therefore I think the real choices that the Obama administration faces, the choice, I should say, is between accelerated withdrawal on one hand and sort of continuing to carry on a kind of meaningless war that the elite itself understands is not winnable, but for political reasons it can't give up. And I'm afraid to say that more and more I'm beginning to feel that that second alternative of a sort of long-term continuation of a war that everybody understands cannot be won and, in fact, is a losing proposition, is more and more likely to be the fate of this country in the coming years.
Gareth Porter is our guest, an investigative historian and journalist focusing on U.S. national security policy. Gareth, in terms of your picture of what's going on in Afghanistan, tell us how this fits in. After the U.S. Offensive in the area called Marja, and rural area in Marja, in February, this was sort of concurrent with the U.S. troop escalation there. And now there's also been a delay of an offensive in Kandahar province from June this month to September, likely. Seems that the Taliban have crept back into Marja.
Right, and I think these are the two variants on this broader theme of a failed strategy. The Marja variant is that the Taliban could not be eliminated in any meaningful way from Marja, and the Kandahar variant is the inability of the United States to be able to get the minimum of political support from either the population or from the village or city elders who represent them in the conferences on this whole question of what are we going to do about Kandahar. So I think the combination of those two stories is really what we're going to continue to see played out. Now, with regard to Marja, I mean, I think that it's important for people to understand one very specific fact that no one else has reported thus far, astonishingly to me, at least, and that is that the military strategy for Marja was an extremely troop-intensive strategy, and that's because they wanted to have a very convincing, very thorough victory in Marja, which would consist of essentially gaining complete control over this area and kicking the Taliban out completely so that there was no Taliban presence in this area. Now, the number of troops that the United States and the British put into Marja was at least estimated at 7,500. But in addition to that, we were told at least that there were another 7,000 Afghan troops who were in the battle, the offensive in Marja. Now, I'm not convinced that there really were 7,000 Afghan troops, and if they were at one point, I think they quickly dwindled down. But let's assume for the moment that there were indeed roughly 15,000 troops, both foreign troops and Afghan troops, who were in on the campaign to get complete control of Marja. Now, this was supposedly it's supposed to be a city of 80,000 people. This is the way it was touted by the Marines in Helmand Province, who basically gave the briefings that the media used to essentially portray this battle to the reading public, to the newspaper and television public. What I found out by really focusing in on this area and looking at a Google Earth image of a 1.2-kilometer sized area of what is called Marja. By the way, Marja is a 120-square-kilometer rural area. There's absolutely nothing urbanized about it. There's not the slightest hint of a city anywhere in that district size rural agricultural area. But by taking a 1.2-kilometer-sized slice of that or piece of that and examining the number of structures, the number of houses in the area, you can give an estimate of about 350 people for that 1.2-kilometer slice, and then multiply that by 100, and you get 35,000 people. So now you have 15,000 troops to try to secure a population of about 35,000 people. That has to go down in history as the most troop-intensive counterinsurgency campaign in the history of warfare. That's nearly one troop for every two members of the civilian population. That's unheard of. It's just impossible that you're going to ever get that kind of troop numbers per population in real life, but that's what they did. And for that Marja offensive to fail as utterly and as clearly as it has is such a clear-cut indication that this strategy cannot possibly succeed in Afghanistan that one has to believe that this U.S. military command in Afghanistan and the Pentagon more generally are very well aware that they simply do not have a chance. The chance of a snowball in hell of succeeding.
Gareth Porter, Afghan President Karzai recently held what they call a Loya Jirga summit meeting of Afghan tribal leaders, and President Karzai has been pursuing in his own way, and it hasn't really come to anything yet, but he's been saying there is no military solution to this war and that we must sit down with the Taliban. How realistic is it that Karzai or the U.S. government or NATO will entertain the idea of serious negotiations with the Taliban when they appear to be winning on the battlefield?
Well, that, of course, is the single biggest question mark in my own mind about this war, is whether there could be a negotiated settlement, which is really the only realistic way out of this war. I mean, there's simply no possibility of using military force usefully from here on in. We have two choices: withdraw either unilaterally or through a negotiated settlement, or to stay and bleed ourselves and do increasing harm to Afghan society and the Afghan people in the process. But nevertheless, your question is certainly a good one. What is the basis, if there is one, for a negotiated settlement, given the fact that the Taliban so clearly are in the driver's seat because they cannot be removed from the heartland of southern Afghanistan, that is Kandahar and Helmand provinces. And by the way, I think most people are aware of this, but it bears repeating that neither the Obama administration nor the U.S. military itself is even claiming that it is theoretically possible to eliminate the Taliban in any meaningful sense from Afghan society and politics. It is explicitly stated on more than one occasion that we acknowledge that the Taliban will be part of the warp and woof, or the fabric of Afghan society. And so, given that fact, how can we negotiate a settlement? Well, I think that the Taliban do, in fact, have an incentive for sitting down and negotiating an agreement that would result in some kind of compromise. First reason, of course, is that it is perhaps the only way to get U.S. troops out of the country for X number of years into the future. The Taliban obviously have an interest in eliminating the foreign military presence, not simply for political reasons, but because they're Afghans and their fellow Afghans are suffering because of the foreign military presence. So, I mean, I think that that is sufficient reason in itself to bring them to the table. And I would add that there is plenty of evidence that the Taliban leadership has been sending signals, albeit somewhat subtle signals, that the U.S. news media has not seen fit to publish, except for my own writing about this, and Anand Gopal, who wrote one piece for the Wall Street Journal. But they have sent signals to the Obama administration that they are willing to meet the single U.S. demand that the U.S. has made explicitly, which is that as part of a settlement, the Taliban has to agree that al-Qaeda cannot have any foothold in Afghan territory. And so they actually had a paper or an article on their website, the website of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and the article stated specifically, explicitly, that we are prepared to give legal guarantees that that there will be no meddling outside our borders. Now, that is, of course, code language for precisely what the United States has been demanding about al-Qaeda. And you hear from many sources that the tensions between Mullah Omar and the Taliban leadership on one hand and the al-Qaeda leadership on the other hand have grown in recent years rather than receding, and that they do not see eye to eye at all on their fundamental interests. So it's quite credible that they are quite serious about this.
And that's important, because the justification from the very beginning in October of 2001 under the Bush administration, the Afghan war has been based on the fact that we're denying, by this conflict, a safe haven for al-Qaeda to train and to launch further attacks against this country and other countries around the world. But, Gareth, we only have a minute or two left, and I wanted to ask you briefly to comment on this. The Pentagon recently made an announcement about Afghanistan's vast riches in mineral wealth, including iron, copper, gold, and lithium. They value it at close to $1 trillion. This information, from what I understand, has been released before. What's behind the Pentagon's timing in releasing this information as the war kind of turns sour?
Well, it's clearly a transparent effort to try to put another reason for the United States staying in Afghanistan for a long, long time on the table. And, you know, my own fear, I have to say, is that it could be successful in the sense that so many people in this country are almost trained like Pavlov's dog to respond to the idea that, if there's wealth there, mineral wealth there that is valuable to the U.S. economy, then of course the United States either is going to have to stay, should stay, on one hand, that's sort of the center and the right, or the left saying, well, of course we shouldn't, but that's the way the United States is. Of course we're going to stay, and there's nothing to be done about it. And I think someone really has to stop and say, now, hold on a minute. There's no good reason for the United States to stay at all. It makes no difference whatsoever to the U.S. economy whether the Chinese are making deals to have mining of various kinds of minerals in Afghanistan or not. They're still going to go on the world market, and we'll get whatever we want to pay for. And so this is all just irrelevant to the real issues that we need to face in Afghanistan.
Well, Gareth, thanks so much for being here tonight. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'd love to have you back to talk more about assessing where we're at with these conflicts and other national security issues. A lot, of course, focused on the Middle East that you work on. The article that we were talking about on the Afghan war, McChrystal Faces Iraq 2006 moment in the coming months, where can our listeners get a copy of that and read it?
Well, it's on IPS.net, and other places include antiwar.com and Counterpunch.
Okay, that's great. IPS.net, none of those other spots. Thank you so much for being here, Gareth.
Thanks again for
having
me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Gareth Porter, an investigative historian and journalist, and his book, published back in 2006, it was titled Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam.